From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
David Margolik is my guest. He's an educator and the author of several books, including The Promise of the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, Beyond Glory, Joe Lewis versus Max Schmeling, and A World on the Brink, and several other books that I have not read. But I have read, and I think you should read, his latest book, When Caesar Was King, How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy. David Margolik, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. It's nice to be here with you.
It's great to have you. I really loved your book, and I laughed a lot. So it's a book that's very funny, and it's kind of a sad, sort of tragic story in a way. I mean, if an artist is a painter, then he can paint in his studio until he's 102, and if people look at his paintings, it's great, and if they don't, great. But if your art is doing live TV out of New York, and that medium goes away, what can you do if it's replaced by the Lawrence Welk show?
Well, that's right. I mean, this is Sid Caesar had a meteoric career, and he came and went very, very quickly in the space of 10 years. And that was one of the challenges in the book, really, was to describe his incredible first appearance on the scene and what a phenomenon he became, and how universally known he was once upon a time. And then what accounted for his equally quick disappearance, although his impact never waned. I mean, we're still feeling it, but the actual image of Sid Caesar, the person of Sid Caesar, the name Sid Caesar, receded, not among people who are genuine students of comedy. They were always aware of him and remain aware of him. And, you know, the list of people that he influenced is very, very long. But his story had been forgotten. And that was the great challenge and great pleasure of doing a book like this. It was, you know, it was one of those rise and fall stories that's really irresistible to a journalist.
Well, I look at a lot of, you know, I'm a fan of comedy and American popular culture. But sometimes I look at some of the people who were renowned in their day. I mean, Jack Benny is still hilariously funny. I love watching Jack Benny or listening to him on the radio. But Milton Berle I find puzzling because the whole world was so thrilled with Milton Berle, Mr. Television. He sold millions of televisions. I don't see anything particularly funny in Milton Berle. And he also lasted a long time beyond his Mr. Television years, but I don't think his stuff holds up or is particularly genius. But I think there's two from that era of television, Ernie Kovacs and Sid Caesar, that really do hold up.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, you're already onto something. I mean, Kovacs also has disappeared to the degree that I don't really understand Kovacs. Huh. I mean, you know, my research was more pointed than that. And I sort of felt that I should understand Kovacs, who was roughly a contemporary of Caesar's. He came along a little bit after it. And I think is even more forgotten in a way than Caesar. Berle was serving warmed over comedy in the early days of television, and it didn't wear well. It had been around a long time, and it was wild and frantic, and I think thrived in part because of the novelty of television. All this warmed over stuff was coming into your house for free once you bought the TV, which was expensive. And people just thought this is the greatest deal in the world, and we're getting it for nothing, and let's all watch it and flush our toilets at the same time during the commercial break so that the water supplies in different cities was jeopardized. But it didn't wear well, and he, you know, was basically burned out very, very quickly. Whereas someone like Jack Benny was just, it's classic comedy, and it's still, as you say, you can listen to some of those old radio broadcasts, and it's still funny. But a very different kind of humor than Caesar's. One of Caesar's writers, I think it might have been Joe Stein, who later wrote Fiddler on the Roof, said he never heard Sid crack a joke. Sid was not one for one-liners. I mean, he never stood up and, you know, with a microphone in front of him and sort of came out with a litany of jokes. I mean, he was the anti-Bob Hope. Mm. Bob, to the right, to Caesar and the writers for him, Bob Hope was the Antichrist. That was what they didn't want to be. That was just wisecracks, and they were aspiring to something much more elevated than that.
Well, you know, that, one of the themes in your book is Judaism and the Jewish comedian ethos. And, well, you know, right now as we're talking, Hope, not Jewish, Benny, Jewish. And Jack Benny also doesn't tell jokes. His comedy is richer the more you listen to his radio program because it was so based on character and right. and his character traits. I'm very curious to know more about the you know, what you're feeling about Jewish culture and the role it plays. And it's also to me something tricky because I know you've written a lot about race. You wrote about the Lewis Schmeling fight and you wrote about the two little girls in Little Rock. And in there was a quote in your book, Albert Goldman, who I'm pretty sure is Jewish, said something about Jewish adrenaline that makes Jews manic and crazy and jumpy and lunatic. And I wonder if that's a little bit racist because Red Skelton was all those things and not Jewish, but also not as funny.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that the Caesar stuff was much more multi-layered than Red Skelton. Red Skelton was kind of treacly and had a couple of gimmicks. The Caesar stuff, as you said about Jack Benny, it was about human nature. It's about character. There was a complexity to it, and there was a kind of wisdom to it. I don't think anybody would ever have accused Red Skelton of being wise. You know, I watched them when I was a kid, unlike Caesar. I mean, Caesar was really before my time. There was a multi-layered quality. In a way, I think that Caesar is not generally connected with Jerry Seinfeld, but it was really, in some ways, a comedy about nothing. It was, you know, nothing except human nature. It was never topical. It was topical in the sense that they would reflect on what was going on in the wider culture, technologically and stuff like that, fighting with to understand technology or modern, you know, like the advent of television and stuff like that. But there was never anything politically topical, in Caesar's shows. Their excuse was, their official fig leaf was that, you know, that's just ephemeral and that's not what we really care about. And that's, again, that's for Bob Hope to do, to make wisecracks about Nixon or Eisenhower that were ultimately sort of approving of these right-wing Republicans. Caesar never, he mentioned Eisenhower once in his decade on TV, and it was sort of an accidental kind of thing. And nothing topical. You could watch Caesar's shows. I say this in the book that you would never know the Korean War was going on. There was never anything about any of that, except during the commercials, Carl Reiner would come out and urge people to donate blood for, you know, for the boys in Korea. And R.J. Reynolds would announce that, you know, out of the goodness of their impaired hearts, that they were sending camels to the front in South Korea. You know, there was never anything off the news like that at all. But, you know, instead they were focusing on human nature and the drama of life in a way and the inherent humor of life. And so there was a complexity and a depth and an eternal quality to their humor, which explains why it wears well even today when you can see it. It's much more, for many years, you couldn't see it. And that was another thing that did Caesar in, which was that his shows were live, which is, you know, as you say, just uncanny to pull off these shows in front of 20 million people with no room to screw up at all. But they weren't bite-sized. They weren't, you know, they weren't sitcoms. Caesar was quite contemptuous of sitcoms and the artificiality of sitcoms, which goes back to his focus on real, on the real. Lucy never went off the air. And we all know, I mean, students of comedy know every one of the Honeymooners episodes inside out, the 39 of the classic ones. And Caesar just disappeared for decades. The best thing that ever happened to Caesar before the DVD was YouTube. You know, that was, there were two good things that happened to Caesar. One was that 10 years or so after he disappeared, these aficionados came out with a compilation of his best sketches on Your Show of Shows. That came out in 1972 or 1973, called 10 from Your Show of Shows. And several of the classic sketches were on there. And, you know, that's what Conan O'Brien saw when he was 10 years old and said to his father, who had brought him there because he thought that, you know, he'd like to see these things. And he came out saying, that's what I want to be. I want to be a comedian. He had seen the famous This Is Your Life sketch, the takeoff of the program This Is Your Life, which I think is the most famous of Caesar's sketches. And what I say, I mean, I've called it the longest laugh, the longest continuous laugh in the history of television. And, you know, as a former New York Times reporter, we always shied away from saying anything categorical in any of our stories because there's always somebody to come out of the woodwork and correct you. That wasn't the first time such and so happened. He wasn't the only person to do this, you know. That wasn't Gilbert and Sullivan originally. That was someone else. But in this case, no one's ever contradicted me that this is the longest laugh in the history of television. And people just hadn't seen that for many, many years. And lots of people still haven't seen it. I was once on a cruise ship with John Cleese. And John Cleese had never seen that sketch. Arguably the greatest sketch in the history of television. American television.
That's right. Not Monty Python. But, you know, although he doesn't do topical Bob Hope kinds of humor, like the Marx Brothers and Woody Allen, you have to know stuff when you're watching Sid Caesar to get his references. I mean, I find now that the Marx Brothers, as wonderful as they are, when you listen to Groucho in those films and he says something like, my friends, there's nothing like liberty except Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post. People don't know what Collier's is, what Saturday Evening Post is, or that there's a magazine called Liberty. You really had to be, you have to be literate and know what they're talking about. If you're doing satire, in order to do satire, you have to know what's being satirized.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of people didn't know when, you know, did someone call me Schnorrer? There were lots of people who didn't know what a Schnorrer was, you know, but there were different things to laugh at. You know, you could miss one of, those. There's no such thing as a sanity clause. I mean, you know, that requires a certain sophistication that would probably have eluded a lot of people. But there's Chico Marx, you know, playing his normal character and he's funny. I mean, Carl Reiner said that there were different things to laugh at, you know, that Gentiles and Jews sometimes laughed at different things. There were little winks in Caesar's comedy to, I mean, this is what Irving Howe called waves to the folks back home. You know, there were certain knowing references that Jews would pick up, although they were never really explicit. I mean, there was very little Yiddish used on any of Caesar's shows, at least the early ones. Later on,
you were talking about a Japanese film parody.
The Japanese film sketches, they discovered that Yiddish, if it was pronounced in a certain way, could sound like an Asian language, you know? And so they worked. I mean, they were feeling a little bit more emboldened. Caesar, this is on Caesar's Hour, the successor to Your Show of Shows. And that was Caesar's own show. It, you know, he was working for somebody else on your show of shows. He was working for Max Liebman, who was the producer and originator of the show. Whereas on Caesar's Hour, he was running. It was his candy store, to use an old idiom. And, so they were flexing their muscles a little bit, and they figured they could throw in a little bit more Yiddish, but they were usually quite careful about that. And they certainly never flaunted their Jewishness. It was something they tried to obscure. They couldn't really, because I mean, the comedy was steeped in the sensibility of Jewish culture. But they never did it explicitly, and they didn't do it obnoxiously, or off-puttingly, in a way that people in the hinterlands wouldn't understand at least some of it. This became a problem later on. I mean, I don't want to, anticipate where you may be going with all this, Gary, but, later on, Caesar didn't play so well outside of the cities where the bulk of television viewership was in the early years of television, when TV was really a Northeast urban phenomenon. And when television spread to the hinterlands, and this is the kind of blessing that a writer, lives for, I mean, the whole juxtaposition of Sid Caesar going up against Lawrence Welk. you couldn't have choreographed a better topic than that for a book. I mean, representing two entirely different sensibilities and worlds and geographical areas and points of view. At that point, even television was spreading so fast in the 1950s that the audience was changing by the day, really. And television, was growing exponentially. I mean, everybody at a certain point, the numbers of televisions was exponential. What's the term? Logarithmic. I mean, it was just, I say in the book there, it was expanding with Malthusian enthusiasm in a way. I mean, it was just growing by meets and bounds, and the audience changed in the process. And that's one of the things that did Sid Caesar in.
We're talking with David Margolik. He's the author of When Caesar Was King, How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. I can see a parallel to our current political situation. You talk about, I can't remember, a television writer saying a 10th-rate musician or a 13th-rate musician,
yeah,
topping a first-rate comedian. And, right now we're we live in a world in which there is a, I don't know what rate to put on our current president. And yet he triumphed over some first rate minds to get where he is.
Well, there's always been this schism in this country. I mean, there've always been his supporters. They supported other people in different eras. I mean, the country has always been, has always been divided into many, many different cultural pieces. And oddly enough, television in its early days represented a sophisticated constituency. And so, a lot of people dismiss early television, but there were pockets of great sophistication because there was an audience for it. And so oddly enough, there's a parallel between early television and cable television. People found their niches in each instance. And it was, in the wide swath of years between the point where television reached its maturity and started to fragment into different audiences. That's when people like Caesar were done in, because then it was lowest common denominatorville. And, and a Caesar just couldn't have survived and wouldn't have survived in that era. That was the era, the Beverly Hillbillies era.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting that a lot of the same people who were making live TV were also the people who created the Beverly Hillbillies and I mean,
no, that's right. And in fact, I had a very dear friend who sort of fit that description. They went where the work was, right?
Yeah.
And the work, this is all these talented comedy writers who had to leave New York to come to Los Angeles to work on Gomer Pyle or the Beverly Hillbillies or My Mother the Car or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where the jobs were. And these were very, very talented people. But that was the kind of work that they had to do, which is one of the reasons I don't think I think even people like Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks in some ways did their best work for Sid Caesar. Because the atmosphere was that much more challenging and the standards were higher. I mean, I've been writing some about Carl Reiner even, you know, since the book came out, in part because of, you know, the awful of, you know, what happened to Rob Reiner and his wife, that whole awful story. But I'm very interested in Carl Reiner quite independently of that. And in a way, I mean, even the Dick Van Dyke Show, the much revered Dick Van Dyke Show, I'm not a scholar of that. We couldn't watch television in my house. Uh-huh. You know, I couldn't watch it without trepidation. You know, there'd be that sound of my father's footfalls on the stairs coming down to where the TV was, you know, and, you know, putting up with his censorious expression on his face when he would see what we were watching. So we never got into the habit of watching. I mean, I came of age, I'm born in 1952. So in the late 50s, early 60s and all of that, we just really didn't watch much TV. So I don't share the great esteem and admiration for the Dick Van Dyke Show that other people have simply because I don't know it. And I'm sure that it was the best of its kind. But my experience with it is that it has the artificiality of a sitcom, which is something that Caesar's shows never did. There was a kind of genuineness to Caesar's shows that didn't exist later on in the sitcoms.
Well, I'm sure the energy of live TV.
Yeah.
We're talking with David Margolik, and his new book is called When Caesar Was King, How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy. David Margolik, there's also something. Let me just say that in praise of your father, the disapproval of television led you to have written a bunch of books, whereas I have just jotted down something on a post-it notepad that I don't know what it means. But I watched a lot of times, sat in front of the TV, you know. I used to watch the test pattern in the morning before the shows came on.
Yeah.
I used to call that show The Whistle. I would sit
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
But there's something a little anti-Semitic about the Dick Van Dyke Show, which you point out in your book that Carl Reiner had originally written a show for him, for himself, but the network rejected it until they put, I think it's Sheldon Leonard's suggestion, they put Dick Van Dyke in the show instead.
Right.
And replaced all the Jews except Maury Amsterdam. I'm thinking Maury Amsterdam must be Jewish in the show. Yeah.
I forget what his, I think his first name was Moritz. Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to kind of get back to this whole Jewish thing because you do talk about it quite a bit in your book and it's puzzling. What do you think accounts for the volume of Jewish comedians given the small percentage of Jews in our population?
I can't really explain it. I mean, there are all of these sweeping millennial descriptions about, you know, Jewish persecution over the years and coping with the struggles of survival and anti-Semitism and enduring anti-Semitism everywhere they went, and the kind of irony and survival skills and skepticism of authority and all of these things that their circumstances would have inculcated in them just to get by. I mean, that's I think that's the sweeping explanation. I mean, it was a survival strategy, and it, you know, it became kind of baked into the Jewish psyche. It may just be that, you know, Jews are different. You know, I mean, it's a chicken and egg kind of, you know, it's like a chicken and egg kind of situation where it's unclear whether it was nature or nurture, and whether it was a response to the circumstances of Jewish life and Jewish endurance and survival, or whether it's just hardwired into us. There's no debating that, you know, we're incredibly overrepresented in comedy. And I think that was truer in Caesar's era than it is now. I mean, comedy, you know, obviously has diversified greatly. And that was one of the attractions of the Caesar story to me, in a way that it captures a moment of Jewish cultural hegemony in one particular field that's never really been replicated and will never be replicated again. You know, when Caesar's Hour was on in its last season, there were seven writers, and all seven of them were Jewish. And I say that it was the kind of thing that wasn't noted by either Philo or anti-Semites. It wasn't talked about, but there it was, you know, and three of the four stars on the show, on your show of shows, were Jewish, and also on Caesar's Hour. So yeah, I mean, our, you know, the numbers were complete, way out of whack, and very striking. And that would never be repeated again, because the television audience, as I say, was changing, and the culture was diversifying, and the prominence of Jews in the culture has gradually waned and continues to wane. I mean, the Jewish population is sort of remain relatively steady, while the country has grown, you know, greatly over the past several decades. And so, the effect has been kind of diminished some. But in the early days of television, there was this group of people who had just had the shackles taken off of them. You know, it was the first sort of truly American Jewish generation. Most of their parents were immigrants, and there were these incredibly talented, energetic, hungry people out there creating in a medium that didn't know what the hell to do. It was wide open, in the same way that motion pictures had been a generation earlier, and so desperate to fill up the space, to colonize all the empty hours of television, that it actually trumped whatever anti-Semitism was still in the culture, in a way. They couldn't hold these people back, and they didn't want to hold them back, because they, you know, they needed them. And so when Caesar was, you know, when Caesar and Max Liebman were offered your show of shows, Sylvester Pat Weaver, the head of NBC, father of Sigourney Weaver, was, you know, took them out to lunch and said, do you want 30 minutes or 60 minutes or 90 minutes? Take your pick. And they, you know, they figured, why not grab for as much as they could get? And then we'll figure out how to fill the time, which is what they did.
I had the opportunity to talk to Carl Reiner on this show a couple of times, and I asked him if Alan Brady, the character that he played on the Dick Van Dyke Show, was modeled after Sid Caesar, which seems so obvious, because
I think I know. Let me test my memory. Okay. and your interviewing, because he told me, and I think he told many people, no, it wasn't Sid Caesar. It was a mix of Sid Caesar, Phil Silvers, and there was one more person.
He told me it wasn't Sid Caesar, because Sid Caesar was a wonderful, sweet guy to work for, and not at all like Alan Brady, who was a narcissist.
All right. Well, that's interesting. That's not the answer that I've heard him, that I heard him give. Hmm. I mean, the real answer, the honest answer, there's the polite, Carl Reiner answer. There are different categories of answers here. The real answer is that Caesar was an enigmatic and frustrating and opaque guy who was very hard to understand. Reiner said in another interview that we used to sit around trying to figure out, just talking about him when he wasn't around, trying to figure out what made him tick. It wasn't that he was, Carl and Howard Morris, the second and third bananas on the Caesar show, knew that Sid was anything but sweet. He was difficult and he was high maintenance and he was impaired and he was drinking too much and he was taking pills and he was impossible to read and he was hard to relate to. And so he wouldn't have been a good character for a sitcom. It just didn't work. Carl Reiner wanted to get away from Sid Caesar in the way that Mel Brooks wanted to get away from him. He didn't lend himself to a sitcom, but that was not the answer that he gave me. He said that, Carl Reiner was a diplomat and it was frustrating. He was a lovely guy, and I don't know whether that was your experience or not, absolutely, Gary. It was mine. Yes. He was very hospitable. He was very generous with his time. He was a very reasonable, affable guy, but he wasn't very, in some ways, he wasn't always very candid. He always wanted everybody to get along. He gave you a very polite, unthreatening, sanitized answer. And he gave me a different kind of sanitized answer.
Oh, I found him to be absolutely wonderful. It was great that I got a chance to talk to him I idolized him and Mel Brooks. I told him that when I was a little boy, I stuttered terribly, which is true, and that I had committed the 2,000-year-old man to memory and I could recite it without stuttering. And he said, my God, that's such a wonderful story. I'm going to have dinner with Mel tonight, and I can't wait to tell him that there's a young man in California who's on the radio. And I said, you think I'm young?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was young.
Well, in fact, you're not young because you were talking about, well, there was something that you said a little while ago that dated you a little bit. I don't know whether you're as old as I am.
Not quite.
Close. Yeah. Okay. Well, you have a great feel for the history of your knowledge of television history is broader than mine.
It's from in front of the television waiting, watching the whistle.
And yeah. Right. Yeah.
But
right.
I used to like to watch things like What's My Line? And I thought that was a great show. I liked the panel shows. Even though I was about five, I still like to watch those.
There's that great takeoff on What's My Line that they did, really brutal, really, really brutal, where Bennett Cerf, they call Bennett Cerf Clifford Gelding. Caesar's comedy was rarely personal, but you could just see that Bennett Cerf really annoyed them. And they thought, they thought he was a stuffed shirt. And I suppose it made it even worse that he was a Jewish stuffed shirt, which is really obnoxious, right? A Jewish snob. And they went after him on that show. The only person they went after more viciously was Lawrence Welk.
Now, David Margulick, in your book, you talk about Lawrence Welk responding positively, saying he got a lot of laughs. Do you think that happened?
Well, I think, Lawrence Welk, was the definition of inoffensive, but he was a smart guy and he realized that, imitation was the sincerest form of flattery. They were publicizing him. I mean, the thing is that their humor was very gentle, but for 3 weeks in a row, 3 weeks out of four, extending over two seasons, they did Lawrence Welk takeoffs. They never did that kind of thing, but they obviously saw that this was an existential threat to their show. And, in addition to their livelihoods being jeopardized, they were, the person who was doing them in was this incredible mediocrity who represented everything unsophisticated. And so it really burned them up. And so they went after him mercilessly, and he just laughed them off and blew them away.
Prevailed, right?
When Caesar's last weekly show was canceled, you know, it was by Lawrence Welk. Lawrence Welk on ABC, lowly ABC, it was Lawrence Welk that knocked him off the air. But those sketches, no one's seen them in 70 years. They're not on YouTube. They weren't in the anthology 10 from your Show of Shows. In fact, they weren't on Show of Shows. They were on Caesar's Hour. And they're just hilarious. They're just wonderful.
Well, I wanted to ask you, David Margalek, when you're doing your research, you talk about the shows week by week, and you give wonderful – I mentioned there's a lot of laughs in the book, and I laugh tremendously. How did you do it? Did you find the shows, the scripts, where are they?
Well, that was the first thing that I had to do. I mean, the first thing is I started this book a long time ago. It took me a long time to do. I was working on other books in the meantime. But my first two missions were to talk to the people who were still around from that era. Sid Caesar, Carl Reiner, Mel Brooks, principally. Plus, you know, various people who were involved in the production of the shows before they died. And then to watch the shows themselves, because it wasn't the kind of thing where, you know, I didn't know the literature. I mean, you could probably tell me, Gary, you know, if I mention, you know, Lucy on the assembly line, you know that,
sure.
you know, or Sergeant Bilko, you know, gambling, you know, over such and so. And you know these episodes, you know, or Ralph Cramden pretending to be the president of the Gotham Bus Company to protect to impress one of Alice's old boyfriends. You know those. The Caesar shows had disappeared. So I learned very fast that most of them were at the Paley Center, the former Museum of Television and Radio, formerly the Museum of Broadcasting before that, in New York. And I live in New York, and so I could watch most of them there. Some of them were at the Library of Congress, and I went to watch some of those there. And then some of them, particularly some of the Caesar's Hour shows, which weren't saved as conscientiously as Max Liebman had saved the Show of Shows. Some of those were at UCLA because that's where Caesar's collection was. Mm. That's where Caesar donated his videos. So I think I ended up watching probably 90% of the shows. Now, that sounds more impressive than it is, because a lot of them, you know, they weren't purely comedy. I mean, the particularly Show of Shows was a variety show. And so there were dance numbers, you know, and there were singers and jumpers and screamers was how Sid referred to them. You know, he didn't have much use for those things, but you had to do them because they gave the comedians a break between their performances, and they stretched out the shows. So that's what I did. I mean, I went out and I watched, as I say, probably 90% of there was a lot of, I was on fast forward a lot, and a lot of the sketches are repetitious. Not surprisingly. I mean, how do you keep it fresh? And the writers were overworked. On your Show of Shows, there were only three writers: Mel Tolkien, Lucille Callan. People have heard of Mel Tolkien because he was associated with All in the Family. Lucille Callan, more obscure, but one of the early women comedy writers. I mean, there was one on I Love Lucy, too, and there was another one on Caesar's Hour. But they were very, you know, they were a very unusual breed. And then the third writer on Show of Shows was Mel Brooks, who basically hounded Max Liebman until he forced him, you know, bugged him into giving him a job. I mean, Max didn't want to hire him because the young Mel was an incredibly irritating guy, and Max Liebman didn't like him. But Sid was amused by him, and so Sid kept him around. He's like a mascot, and Sid paid him out of his own pocket. And Mel sort of infiltrated that show. He didn't walk through the front door. He made himself indispensable, and he eventually got hired. And the event, even after that, even after he was hired, he wasn't in the credits at first, but, you know, he was insistent and dogged, and he eventually got into the credits and became irreplaceable, really indispensable. And if you watch the early Caesar shows, you know, the Caesar student, the students of Caesar know that he, one of the characters that he played was the German professor with, you know, with the fake German accent and the battered clothes, who was an authority on everything, an authority on mountain climbing, an authority on psychoanalysis, an authority on movie making, you know, an authority on, you know, every archaeology, you know. And there are these back and forths with Carl Reiner, the eternal interviewer, Carl Reiner, you know, later the interlocutor on the 2,000-year-old man sketches that you could quote from memory. And Carl Reiner would interview Caesar about his expertise, and they're really very funny. And these are all Mel Brooks. I mean, there's this treasure trove of early Mel Brooks that no one has seen in 75 years. It's just waiting to be rediscovered. And they're charming and very funny. And to me, in some ways, funnier than his movies. It's what I said. I mean, I think a lot of these comedians, a lot of the writers and comics associated with the Caesar show never did better work after they worked for Caesar. That was the atmosphere, you know. I mean, later on Caesar's Hour, Larry Gelbart was on, you know, a writer for them, and Neil Simon, Larry Gelbart, Neil Simon, and Mel Brooks, all writing for one comedian. Amazing. When Caesar was doing our specials, there was one that was jointly written by Woody Allen and Mel Brooks. Can you imagine Woody Allen and Mel Brooks collaborating on a television show? And the odd thing about that,
Is it funny?
It was a good show, but it was the first show the first of Caesar's shows ever to use a laugh track, believe it or not. You know, as if those two guys could not be trusted to write a funny show. They needed to supplement it.
Well, maybe it was the audience couldn't be trusted to laugh at it.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
We're talking with David Margolik. He's the author of When Caesar Was King, How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Well, you know, it's interesting when you talk about watching these things at the Museum of Radio and Television, which used to be one of my favorite haunts when I went to New York. When you're watching stuff later, it's funny, but you're missing the moment. Like, I remember when Saturday Night Live first came on 50 years ago, and I was ripe for that show. That show was really it was like, wow, our generation has taken over television. And it was so funny and marvelous. But when you look back on those first five seasons with the original cast, they're not unfunny, but they're not like the genius that they felt like at that moment. There's something about the moment of it as well as the content of it.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about before about Milton Berle.
Yeah.
And that, after all of the years of sort of repression on television, this Saturday Night Live was a big burst of energy, a comic energy, and they were filming it live, or at least a lot of it live. And the sheer novelty, as with Burl, the sheer novelty was what carried it over, but didn't age well in a way. You're saying it didn't age well. And one of the ironies, I tried to interview Lorne Michaels for this book.
Yeah.
And I was told that he was busy for the next 6 months. So, you know, it was a polite way of saying buzz off. Mm. Right. And he, you know, he was cooperating with Susan Morrison on the book that she was doing on him. So he clearly didn't want to talk to me. But he was quoted. So I tried to find interviews to establish whether there was a connection between Saturday Night Live and Caesar's shows, because that's generally the lineage. I mean, people say there's a connection, right? And from the limited amount that I had seen Saturday Night Live, I didn't see it. Okay. And when, and in those instances where Lorne Michaels talked about his influences, he said that he found Milton Berle funnier than Sid Caesar in one of the interviews. And that would explain the, you know, your experience in going back and watching these things. They haven't aged well. They're not classics. And oddly enough, there's one more prong to this story, which is that Caesar guest hosted on Saturday Night Live in 1983 during the Dick Ebersol interregnum when Lorne Michaels was gone. And he was scandalized by how sloppily the show was put together. Hmm. So they would work on 30 different sketches at once and not develop any of them and pick the, whatever they were going to run at the last minute. And the chaos was thought to be part of the creative process. There was nothing chaotic about Caesar's shows. They were scripted. They were disciplined. The image of them in My Favorite Year is utterly unfair to Caesar. Mm. There was never chaos. You know, there was never mayhem. You know, things didn't fall apart. Okay. Even on the famous This Is Your Life sketch. The funniest sketch in the history, the longest laugh in the history of television, which was heavily improvised because of Howard Morris playing Uncle Goopy and, you know, this incredibly emotional reunion between Sid and his uncle, the Sid character and his Uncle Goopy. Even though there was considerable improvisation in that sketch, it was scripted. I mean, there was a script that they followed. So when Caesar went on Saturday Night Live, he was really entering alien territory. And it sort of showed, and afterwards, you know, he badmouthed the people on the show. They were very nice to him. They were nice to him because they treated him like a comic icon. It's interesting to watch when he came out at the beginning of the show. You know, Eddie Murphy and Julia Louis-Dreyfus were in the cast then, and they're telling everybody to stand up. I mean, you know, a comic legend is coming out here now. Pay him proper respect. And that was a reaction that Caesar got wherever he went. All of the younger comics, the people who knew him, particularly the people who'd grown up watching him, really worshiped him. And it was something that it was a phenomenon that I was reminded of every time I interviewed a younger comic. I mean, not young now, but Carol Burnett or Billy Crystal or Johnny Carson. I didn't interview Johnny Carson, but all of these people, when they talked about Sid Caesar, they talked about him reverentially. And when Caesar was down and out and really on the skids, they took care of him. They paid homage to him. They honored him by having him as impaired as he was on their shows. And you can watch it, really very moving, that Johnny Carson people, the people who handle his shows now, were wonderful to me. And they tracked down the old Carson shows where Caesar came on. And you can see the reverence that Johnny had for him. Johnny was showing some of his sketches and they took there was a commercial and they came back and Johnny said to the audience, you know, Sid was just telling me about these sketches. And I interrupted him and I said, Sid, you don't have to tell me about these sketches. I watched every one of them. You know, I memorized every one of them. I ripped them off from my own comedy routines in college, you know, and Carol Burnett designed her show after Caesar's show. You know, Billy Crystal also went into comedy because he mimicked Uncle Goopy clinging to, you know, to Sid Caesar's leg in that sketch. You know, and this was Dick Cavett was the same way. I mean, he described watching Sid. Where is he from? Omaha?
Nebraska somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Omaha. He was watching him, you know, watching Sid in New York perform his shows and watching from Omaha and saying to himself, how do I get from here to there? That's what I want to do. How do I do it?
Yeah.
That was the impact that he had, which was why when you talk to any of these people, including Mel Brooks, and including Woody Allen, both of whom I interviewed, they were generous in talking about Sid And they just went on and on. They were not, I often feel, you know, you interview these famous people and they can't wait to get rid of you. Right. but not these guys, because they felt they had a debt to pay. They wanted to honor him. And they felt that Sid had been shafted by history. There's this wonderful story that Woody Allen told me about that he and Dick Cavett went to see the old Sid Caesar, who was performing at Michael's Pub with Imogene Coca. They were sort of tied to one another for the rest of their careers. And they would, you know, as older performers, they would go out and put on shows for the people who remembered them and felt the same way, the same worshipful way about them. And that Woody explained how he and Dick Cavett had gone backstage after the show. And there was Sid, and Sid saw Woody Allen, and he said to him, you know, imagine I'm going to be a footnote to your career. Sid said that. And Woody said, what are you talking about? You're Sid Caesar. You were the greatest comic who ever lived. You know, he couldn't believe that Sid would say that, but that was the position, that was the level to which Sid had sunk. That's a tongue twister
right there.
Yeah.
Well, you do a marvelous job, David Margolick, of bringing Sid Caesar and his glory days to life in your book. It's called When Caesar Was King: How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy. And the author, my guest, David Margolick, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thank you. And thank you for understanding and respecting this world as deeply and as appreciatively as you do. I mean, you come to this discussion with a vast body of knowledge, and it's a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. That was David Margolick. His new book is called When Caesar Was King: How Sid Caesar Reinvented American Comedy. Sid Caesar's second banana on your show of shows and Caesar's Hour was the late, great Carl Reiner, who went on to create The Dick Van Dyke Show. I had the opportunity to talk with Carl Reiner here on From the Bookshelf about the making of The Dick Van Dyke Show, and I thought you might like to hear a little bit of that right now.
Yeah, that was a very interesting part of my life. I had just finished doing the show of shows, and the review format was persona non grata. They weren't doing it anymore. It was 10 years before Carol Burnett brought the review format back to television. So there was nothing there were horses and guns then. A lot of westerns were done, and situation comedies prevailed. Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best, and somebody sent me some a script of a situation comedy, and it wasn't very good, and then I turned it down, and my wife said, why don't you write one? And I had never written a situation comedy, and I'd never written anything, but I think I had written Into Laughing, a novel by then, I'm not sure. Anyway, so I wrote this pilot based on my life in New Rochelle, and I remember riding on the highway going home to New Rochelle and saying, what piece of ground do I stand on that nobody else stands on? And I said, well, I live in New Rochelle, I work in New York, I'll write about that. And that's how the Dick Van Dyke Show was born. Actually, it was Head of the Family was born. I wrote the pilot, and it was picked up by a guy named Peter Lawford, who wanted to be a producer. And I was in Fire Island at the time, and I said, hey, if I do a pilot, I better have a Bible of scripts ready for other writers to write about. So on that summer in Fire Island, I wrote 13 episodes of Head of the Family, and I got to do the pilot, a one-camera show, no audience, which we played it for an audience, captured their laughs, and went on the air. It was okay. I did it with Barbara Britton and Morty Gunty and Sylvia Miles, two wonderful actors, but I was just fair in it, and it didn't sell. We tested it. It went on once and didn't. And I was very disenchanted with it as well. That's my best shot for television. And at that time, I started to write movies. I started writing a thing called The Thrill of It All. Larry Gelbart and I had an idea, and I wrote a script called The Thrill of It All. and I was involved with that. And Sheldon Leonard, who had read these 13 scripts that my agent was dying to somebody to use, he called me in and he said, these are good. I think we could do a show with them. And I said, I remember saying, Sheldon, I don't want to fail with the same material twice. And he said, this is a good impression of him, by the way. You won't fail. We'll get a better actor to play you. And he suggested Dick Van Dyke, and the rest is history.
No, but Dick Van Dyke, he's a guy whose his comedy is very physical. He's really tied into his torso and how he moves. He's like a silent comedian. I remember, in fact, when he had a series later, he always had a silent sequence in that.
Well, you know, I did a movie with him called The Comic, which was maybe the best acting you'll ever see. Dick Van Dyke is a consummate artist. He's not only an actor, a dancer, a singer, a banjo player. He can do anything. He really can do anything. He's an extraordinary talent. And when he did the Dick Van Dyke Show, his glibness, I mean, his ability to learn a line and turn it into something gold was inspirational for me. I love writing for Dick. And to this day, he is the single most talented human being I've ever worked with. Well, Mel Brooks, as far as funny, there's nobody funnier in the whole world than Mel Brooks. Oh, yes. Well, the original 13 scripts were one-camera shows, and I had to write them for three cameras, which means that we're going to do it in sequence for an audience. The other one was done in pieces, and it was a revelation because it was so wonderful. To hear the audience laughter, capture their laughter, and not add any laughter. As a matter of fact, our laugh trap was captured by a guy named Charlie Douglas, who used to work on our show when we sort of cut off a scene abruptly. There would be a cutoff of a laugh. You'd ha, ah, and it would stop. He would trickle it off with a ha. And that's all he did for us. But he loved the laugh track so much that he put it in his machine, and he used it on other one-camera shows so that our laugh was heard. As a matter of fact, I wrote about it. Barbara Vane, who later became an actor on our show and became, you know, Mission Impossible. She was Cinnamon Carter. She was brilliant. She used to come to all our earlier shows and laugh out loud. So I used to tell people that Barbara Vane is laughing on shows. You'll hear her laughing on shows she's never seen because she was all these other shows.
So when we're watching Get Smart, we're really hearing the laugh track from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yes.
You know, you have this marvelous ear for dialogue. You know, the dialogue sounds so natural. When I was reading it on the page, it was hard to believe that anybody had written it because it seems to flow out of the actors so naturally.
I know. That was the trick of it. I said, to make it fancy, and one of the things I assiduously did was not use any slang, so the fact that I knew this, we were doing something very special. I knew it would last. And look, we're still playing it on television every night because it sounds, you know, it sounds human. And I said, only write about who you are and what you are. I mean, we writers are no different than the audience. We feel the same. We get angry. We get jealous. We do all the things that everybody does. So just write about yourself and you'll be touching into everybody else's lives.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.